From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast episode 64 for Friday the 24th of February 2012. On the show today, who fancies a 7-day journey in an elevator to get 36,000 kilometres into space? One Japanese construction firm is planning on building a space elevator that would do just that. Plus, a new system for operating electric wheelchairs has been conceived, and it uses a wheelchair user's tongue as a means of control. And should our government spend money to route an undersea fibre optic cable to St Helena's 4,000 residents? We'll debate that and much more on today's show. Ahoy there, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And of course, our associate editor, Olivia _Solon.
Hello.
And we're recording on a Friday morning. We usually record on a Thursday afternoon when we're tired.
It's good. We're fresh.
We're wide awake.
We are. It's powerful.
Yeah. Later on, we've got a big bonus if you're one of our listeners who wants to get in touch, because we now have a phone number where you can call and leave us voicemail messages. They'll sound like this.
Hello, Wired.co.uk podcast. My name is Duncan, and I think I'm actually on the show this week, but who knows, maybe not. The rest of the team would like to say hello to you. Can everybody say hello, please?
Hello.
Don't know if you heard that.
So if you want to sound like that, we've got details of how to call in at the end of the show. Listen out for that. We've also got a great feature from the site of the new Blackfriars rail station, which reopened this week in London. It's the first station ever to span the width of the Thames. It was an enormous feat of engineering to construct part of this war, or to reconstruct part of this war-damaged old Victorian bridge for a new purpose. So we've gone to the construction site to find out more and talk to some of the people responsible for its building. Look out for that later, but first some news. Duncan, the coalition government has revived some plans for spying on us.
Yes.
I'm frightened. I'm shaking in my in my converses.
Are you terrified?
I'm medium terrified.
Well, you should be terrified. Calm down. A few years back, the Labour government proposed to a kind of central database that all ISPs and phone networks would have to store data in that could then be accessed by a range of government agencies. Now, they wanted to store the kind of data about your calls, your texts, your emails, not the contents of those things, but the kind of like whens and wheres and all of that stuff. And
so like I Nate Langson called Duncan Gear at 11:02 a.m. on Friday the 24th of February.
Yeah, probably just actually the phone number, so 07 whatever called blah, blah, blah at that time. Uh-huh. And they were in these locations. But it was pretty much canned after a massive outcry over the amount of government agencies that were available for it and that would have access to it, sorry. And at the time, the Conservatives called Labour's privacy record reckless all about it, which is quite fighting words. But the coalition has sort of come out over the last week or so and said, yeah, that plan, yeah, let's do that again.
So it's a difference here that whereas before the individual bodies held their own data, they're now putting it into a central repository.
No, it's actually the opposite. Beforehand, the proposal was for a central repository, whereas now the ISPs, the mobile phone networks, would have the responsibility to look after the data and then provide it to the security services when asked for it.
I think that they already keep some of this data. It's just the access that they're now giving to the government.
At the moment, there's kind of a voluntary data retention scheme that ISPs have where they have to keep some data for about 12 months. And this seems like a much stricter system that would be basically not voluntary.
Voluntary at all, no. It's thought that the plans have been kind of in negotiation with the ISPs and the phone networks and the government since the start of 2012, and they could be launched as soon as May in time for the Olympics.
And so who would be able to have access to these records, and how? I mean, could they just get them immediately, or do they have to go through some kind of process?
We don't know totally for sure until they're kind of officially announced. I imagine these are things that are still being worked out. But we do know that it was MI5, MI6 and GCHQ who were lobbying for this and who convinced the Home Office that this was something that was necessary.
So I suppose they're looking at kind of terrorism as a means to make this happen.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But then we've kind of seen people like the Serious Organised Crime Agency dipping into copyright infringement lately. Mm. So there's definitely a kind of a worry to be had about the expansion of powers like this.
Yeah, there have been cases, I think, in the past, not just in the UK, but particularly over things like, child sex abuse websites, where these sort of databases can be pinpointed to show that a user accessed such and such an IP address where illicit material was being hosted at. But I think it's always easy to get these things pushed through as law if you use the word terrorism.
Yeah.
Well, you could get away from these sort of laws by going 36,000 kilometers into space. And a construction company in Japan called Obayashi Corporation has unveiled plans to build a space station 36,000 kilometers above the Earth and want to build a giant space elevator that would transport scientists and tourists to it from Earth.
Sorry, when are they going to do this?
Well, they want to do it by 2050.
2050. So yeah. They've got a little while.
They've got a little while. Now, this is, to put this into context, the International Space Station is 330 kilometers above Earth. 330. This space station and the physical elevator that would connect it to the Earth would be 36,000 kilometers. And if you got into an elevator, it would take you just over 7 days traveling at 200 kilometers an hour to get there.
A long way away, essentially.
It's a long way away and would take a long time. Now, obviously, part of this, you know, is tourism, but it is also research. And it would be powered by giant solar panels on the top of this space elevator that would collect, obviously, solar rays from space. But the question here is, and you asked this before the show, are they going to do this? And I think the answer there is, we have no idea.
Well, I think it's the same as, you know, in 1950, asking whether we're all going to be living in undersea cities by the year 2000. And we're not.
No, but I mean, it's far enough in the future for them to move ahead with plans and then to sort of ditch them and for no one to remember that they even had the plans to begin with. But the company does have a decent track record of building some pretty big stuff. They worked on the Tokyo Skytree, which is this giant 1,000-foot-high tower in Tokyo that broadcasts TV and radio signals. It's got restaurants. It's a giant observatory as well.
That's a big leap from a 1,000-foot tower to a space elevator that goes up 36,000 kilometres.
Yeah. I mean, a space elevator, Duncan, you know how these things work. Do you want to explain how
they don't work because they don't exist.
How they are theorised to work in the works of science fiction.
In sci-fi, yeah. I mean, it's basically just a big cable that goes up into space and is anchored to something that's up there. And then it's got a, it's kind of got a module, which would be the elevator in this case, that zips up and down that cable. And obviously the cable can send electricity back down. It's kind of tethering a space station to the Earth and then using using friction to help you kind of pull, or magnetism or some other force to help you propel up that cable.
But surely a giant any cable that was 36,000 kilometers long would be ridiculously heavy. So how would it not pull down whatever?
You've asked a great question there, Liv.
Object is at the end of it.
I'm not sure anybody really knows.
I think they'll probably use, you know, carbon nanotube rope or something along those lines to sort of build the cable itself, which will be lighter. I mean, I think almost certainly they're relying on us having future materials that will enable us to do this.
Future stuff.
Sounds woolly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, would you go in a space elevator for 7 days? Would you want to spend 7 days in a lift?
Yeah, kind of. It'd be pretty awesome. But
I mean, it's not just going to be like in a shopping centre a lift, is it?
It can't be that much bigger. It can take 30 people at once.
I think that'd be an amazing view.
That's 30 people's, you know, living space for 7 days rather than just seven people cramped into a
that's
cylinder.
A good point. This thing would be huge. Imagine seeing that thing flying at 200 miles an hour, 36,000 kilometers into space.
It would be like a Holiday Inn lifting off.
Yeah, the more I mentally image this, the weirder and fluffier it sounds. We'll see. We'll keep our eye on it. Check back in 40 years' time. Liv, let's bring ourselves back to Earth. A tongue-controlled wheelchair. This is a fascinating new bit of innovation.
Yeah, this is from electrical engineers at the Georgia Institute of Technology. And what they've done, they've developed this dental retainer with lots of different sensors on it, which can be manipulated with the tongue to steer an electric wheelchair. Now, this is for people who've got very high-level spinal cord injuries, i.e. people who don't have use of their arms and legs. And so they need to use something on their head to direct their wheelchair. And often this is kind of blinking or blowing through a straw is sometimes.
You can suck and blow, and they're two different. One's probably go and one's probably stop.
Exactly. Now, the cool thing about it, which I didn't know about before, but it has been used in other devices, is they give people who are going to use this system a tongue piercing, and they put a magnet on the top of the tongue piercing, and they use that to manipulate the sensors in the mouth.
Okay, so it's like a bridge that goes on the roof of your mouth.
Yes.
And each one, we've seen a photograph, I think, of which parts of the mouth.
Yeah, I think it's fairly intuitive. It's whatever side of the mouth is the kind of steering, and there's places in to click to either select something on a computer screen, which you could also use it for, or to kind of stop or start.
A magnet on your tongue piercing, though, that could lead to problems if you're getting sort of fed by, I don't know, a fork or something like that. It'll get stuck.
It could do, Duncan, but I think that's probably the least of their problems. Yeah. If they want to get around,
have to use plastic forks all the time.
Yeah. I think you would have to put your wheelchair on stop or put the brakes on, because if you were chewing and if you were able to chew, you wouldn't want to sort of put a carrot in your mouth and suddenly fly into the plate.
Yeah. Now, this isn't the first tongue-controlled system. There have been other ones that they've developed, but the previous ones relied on having a very clunky kind of headset with the sensors on the outside of the face. And if it got slightly bumped, the whole system would have to be recalibrated. But the kind of benefits of this one is the fact that the retainer is perfectly moulded to the upper mouth, as normal retainers are. And so it's much less likely to move.
Now, I mean, these are probably a little while away from being used for people. Has there been any kind of clinical trial yet?
They're testing it with able-bodied people at the moment, and then they're going to start a clinical trial with people with the high-level spinal cord injury soon.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes on it. Our eyes are also on the Great Barrier Reef. The Catlin. The Catlin Sea View Survey is a forthcoming scientific expedition to study and document the composition of coral reefs on the Great Barrier Reef and in the Coral Sea. It's not a Google project as such, but Google is a partner for this, and it means that the data and the photographs and the panoramas that this survey is going to capture will be fed into Google Earth and Google Maps. So hopefully later on this year, we'll be able to use Google Earth to sort of fly around these amazing 360-degree photographs and panoramas of the Great Coral Reef and its beasts within.
So how are they capturing it?
They're capturing it with this bespoke 360-degree camera, not dissimilar to the ones that you see on the top of Google Street View cars. But this one has been built inside a kind of probably about a metre or 2 metre long device. I'm not exactly sure how long, but it looks like a giant squid. It really does. And on the front of it, it's got these 360-degree cameras on it. Sort of each one's in this sort of Perspex-looking dome. And there's a scuba diver behind, sort of holding the rear. And it flies through about 4 kilometres an hour, capturing photos as it goes and geotagging them as well.
Is it just the coral that they're documenting?
No, there are 3 different parts of this survey. The first thing they're going to be photographing is just the shallow reefs. So that's the stuff that's quite close to the surface. One is for deep water, which is actually going to be photographed at a fairly, I think, unprecedented depth of 100 metres.
There won't be divers at that level.
No, that must be automated. Mm-hmm. And then there's something called the megafauna survey, which is going to be tracking the marine beasts down there, and that is to look at their migration patterns as well. So 3 different parts of this survey, and all the photographs from this are going to be on Google Earth, hopefully within the next few months.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah, it should be pretty good. There's no release date for the images, but as soon as they are online, you can guarantee we're going to have some of them on the website, so keep your eyes out for that. Now we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll discuss the campaign to wire up a tiny remote island in the Atlantic with a fibre optic cable.
Wired magazine, now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Now, Duncan, you wrote a fascinating piece this week about St. Helena, which is this tiny little island in the Atlantic that has only about 4,000 residents, and there is a campaign to get it wired up to the interwebs.
Yes, that's right.
Now, explain what is so special about this island, first off.
Well, almost nothing. It's the only thing that's really particularly special about it is that it's so far away from everything else. It kind of sits somewhere between, Brazil and South Africa, right in the middle of absolutely nowhere. It's where Napoleon got exiled to after he was captured by the British.
Huh. Is it a British territory?
It is a British territory. It's been British for, I think, about 400-500 years or so. Originally discovered by the Dutch and the Portuguese, but they abandoned it after not being able to put it to any use whatsoever. But after sort of during the great age of sail, it was widely used with ships sort of traveling from Africa to South America. It was used as a kind of stopping off point. And so hundreds of ships would stop by every month, thousands in a year, bringing supplies. And it sustained a population of up to nearly 10,000 people by, I think, about 1900. But ever since powered shipping began and boats no longer had to rely on trade winds, the island's population and economy have declined, and that pace was accelerated by civil aviation, and now the population is around 4,000, half of its all-time high. The difficulty about St. Helena is about how hard it is to get there. There's no airport on the island yet, though one is being built right now. It's served by a single ship, the RMS St. Helena, which calls kind of once a week, once every 2 weeks, between Cape Town, St. Helena, and Ascension Island, which is another tiny little island owned by the Brits in the Atlantic.
And that's to deliver things like post and supplies and stuff like that, right?
Post supplies, passengers, like anything that goes to the island has to be delivered by that ship.
I see. So internet, it strikes me, would be pretty critical to this island's ability to communicate with the outside world, in a sense.
Yeah.
And at the moment, it has a tiny little 10 megabit connection, which is only about 1/20th as fast as the one I have in my own house, which has to be shared between these 4,000 residents.
That's right. They've got a satellite link, which is kind of, it only works patchily. And when there's solar flares and things like that, it has to be shut down. It's not the most reliable system. And of that 10 megabit, the government reserves 1.5 megabit, so the remaining 8.5 megabits has to be split between the entire population. And the average salary on the island is only at about £4,000. And a chunk of that bandwidth that is something like 300 kilobits a second, with a data allowance of a mere 3.3 gigabytes, costs a third of the average islander's annual salary.
So we really need faster internet, or at least they really need faster internet. And there is a campaign to route one of the undersea fiber optic cables, which connects massive internet backbones to each other, to basically route it to this island.
Yeah, that's right. A company called E5 is planning to build a cable called the South Atlantic Express, which is a 12.8 terabit fiber optic connection that will go between Cape Town and Brazil. And a German chap called Christian von der Rop, who has never actually been to the island, is leading this campaign to change the route slightly of this cable so that it swings past St. Helena and a branch can be built off to the island to give them change their lives, essentially. Mm.
So there could be a massive benefit to the economy if the internet there was sped up to the extent that they could do things like, remote medical work, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, not just the economy, the lives of these people, the social factors are just as important. Education could be dramatically changed. There's no, obviously, higher education on the island, and allowing people to distance learn with video and stuff like that could be a dramatic boost. Medicine, you mentioned, allowing data to be sent over to external specialists is really important. Tourism is a big deal, and also, interestingly, representation. There's a proposal that some of these islands in the Atlantic be able to elect an MP that would sit in the House of Commons and actually represent them to the government that's making decisions about their existence. Right now, they don't have any representation whatsoever. And being able to kind of be part of a democracy that's 7,500 kilometres away is very difficult if you haven't got, reliable communications.
So what are the barriers to entry to this? Why might it not happen?
Well, cost is basically the big one. Von der Rop has managed to persuade E5 CEO to say that she's willing to change the course of the cable, which is a big win. But the problem is that she said it will cost kind of in the mid-single-digit millions extra over their current plans to do that. And that money's got to come from somewhere.
And the argument is it should come from our government, since it's a British territory.
Yeah, von der Rop thinks that the British Department for International Development should be paying for it. They're the people who are building the airport that I mentioned before, which was signed off, I think, just last year. And that's going to cost between £200 and £300 million. So in the mid-single-digit millions, to have such a dramatic impact on these islanders' lives as this internet connection would have, seems actually quite good value.
So what can people do? I mean, how could we make this happen? Because it seems to me to be rather good.
Well, von der Rop has got he's set up an e-petition on the British government's website for doing these things, but it's only got 385 signatures on it last time I checked. And
it's quite hard to make it go viral when none of the people who are real stakeholders have any access to the internet.
Well, exactly. And to actually trigger a debate in the House of Commons, you need 100,000 signatures. So he's 99,615 short.
So we have a story on the website explaining, pretty much everything we've just talked about. I think if you search for St. Helena, you'll find it. And there's a link to that petition if you want to get involved. And frankly, I mean, it strikes me that it's a very, very small cost for what could be an enormous benefit.
I think that's the thing, really. This would be, von der Rop says, the first time that a landing point for a cable has been chosen purely for social reasons rather than, economic or infrastructure reasons. He says that he's amazed that the company is ready to land the cable available on St Helena if somebody pays for it, and had expected that to be the highest hurdle. But it looks like now funding from the UK government is the problem. So if you want to find out more about the campaign, then yeah, there's a link to it from our website. If you search for St Helena, you will find everything you need to know.
Staying on the topic of the internet, but bringing it a little bit closer to home, the Pirate Bay has been ruled to infringe copyright and could be blocked in the UK, Liv.
Yes, this is a case brought to the UK's High Court by, surprise, surprise, Sony, EMI and Universal.
Though not Warner.
Not Warner. I guess they're just taking a backseat on this one. But what they want to do is force ISPs like Sky, TalkTalk, Virgin to block access to the Pirate Bay, as they did with Newsbin in July last year. And a decision is going to be made in around June this year, but it's the... website's already been found to incite and persuade users to commit copyright infringement. So it's not looking good for the Pirate Bay.
But the question is, as always, is there any point to this sort of thing? I mean, the, you know, getting rid of Newsbin or blocking it didn't exactly change how many people were accessing it, really.
No, not at all. In fact, 93% of the users of Newsbin who were blocked by BT actually downloaded a piece of software that that allowed them to view all the content. So it was a very, very minimal impact that it had.
And what's more, it's very easy for people to host their own copy of the Pirate Bay. Recently, the site launched a copy of the site that is 90 megabytes in size that anyone can download and host on a server wherever they want.
And this was around about the same time that they moved from being, I think it was .org, to a .se domain to avoid prosecution from the US, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, it's been pretty condemned by people like the Open Rights Group. Peter Bradwell called the move a technologically naive reaction that is both pointless and dangerous.
I have to agree. I mean, we've seen this time and time again, where blocking these sort of sites has absolutely no effect on... curbing piracy. You know, there are so many of these sites that serve the same purpose. Everything from back in Napster, did shutting Napster down stop it? It's just whack-a-mole. Yeah. As is the popular comparison.
I mean, I very much think that shutting, you know, enacting some kind of block against the Pirate Bay here is going to have about as much impact on piracy as piracy is having on the entertainment industry in general. Nothing.
We asked for some feedback, actually, on this matter, whether it was pointful or pointless, and got a couple of choice examples from our Facebook users. Adam Crook says, companies like Love Film and Netflix, among others, are doing a good job with reasonable prices, but it's still going to be a while before content is going to be constant and up-to-date enough to be a main source of viewing. So Adam arguing that basically the legal alternatives aren't up to snuff, which is always the problem, that, you know, we should be offering better services to combat piracy, not just trying to shut down each and every, you know, copyright infringing site that pops up.
I mean, I'd argue that in the case of music, that's happened.
Yeah, I mean, Spotify itself has said they're not competing with iTunes, they're competing with piracy, which is makes a lot of sense. Mm. They really are.
And I'd argue that Netflix as an interface is a much better alternative to piracy. It's just the catalogue that they've got to sort out.
Well, another user commented on Facebook, Minkus Q Minkerson.
I hope that's their real name.
That's an awesome name.
Sincerely hope so. Says, I think the principle behind blocking the site within the UK is because UK law enforcement has no jurisdiction where the Pirate Bay operates, and it's theoretically easier to create laws that domestic ISPs have to follow than it is to work with foreign law enforcement to otherwise take the site offline, especially in cases where different nations' laws may differ. That is also a very good point.
Yeah.
You know, if you can't kill the source, then try and block it, you know.
But it's such a shame for all these ISPs who market themselves on making communication easier and better, and they are being completely stifled by this sort of legislation. It's, from a branding perspective, disastrous.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that if there was a problem with Royal Mail, this is essentially like taping up everybody's mailbox.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not Royal Mail's fault that stuff goes through its system, you know, might be dodgy. You could send a pirated CD through the post, but that doesn't mean that it's Royal Mail's fault any more than it's the ISP's fault for what people download over its networks. But let us know what you think, though, if you want to get in touch, facebook.com/wiredUK. And on that note, we're going to move on to our feature, which concerns the repurposing of a very old bridge. The Blackfriars Railway Station, just up from the Tate Modern in London. It's the first railway station to span the entire width of the River Thames. Also has the world's biggest solar roof to feature on any kind of bridge in the world. Joining me, Katie Scott.
Hello.
And you have been investigating this bridge. Well, not the bridge, the station on top of it, because... Well, it's kind of a feat of engineering, what they've done with this bridge and this station.
It is. It's quite impressive. It's basically the station itself is built on a 124-year-old wrought iron structure. And the engineers had to widen this bridge by as much as 9 metres along most of its length in order to incorporate the new station.
So you spent the day with a hard hat on walking around this station to find out how they've done what they've done. What was it like going down there?
Well, I actually started off in the entrance hall for the tube station because it was the day that the tube station reopened. And whereas before it had been really, really dingy, dark, Victorian entrance hall, it's now vast. It's this huge vaulted glass ceiling. And for anyone who's ever travelled through that station, it's pretty much unrecognisable. And that's basically where I started off the tour. I caught up with Charles Latu-Smith, who's the senior consultant for Jacobs, and they were the lead designer on the entire project. And as well as being incredibly proud of what they've achieved, he was also quite open about some of the problems that the designers and the builders had actually making the whole thing happen.
We're surrounded by roads, we're surrounded by buildings, and we've got an awful lot of assets structured below, actually, what you know, which none of us can actually see here. We've got a large diameter Victorian tunnel, which within that we have a 36-inch gas main, we have water pipes, we have high voltage cables, and all of those things that we had to consider during both the design and the construction stage.
There was also the fact that they had to keep the Circle and District Line tube trains, which are two different lines on the London Underground system, running the whole time that this work was going on. Although, even though the trains themselves weren't actually stopping at Blackfriars, right?
Yeah, what they did was they basically made a huge steel box, which they lowered down a ventilation shaft in sections. And this was designed to protect the tracks and also the trains. And apparently, at some point in the future, this will be removed. I actually grabbed David Wilson, who's communications manager for Network Rail, on the platform of the Overground station, which is next door. And he said that to keep the trains running, it had been all about planning.
So we currently have 15 trains every hour passing through Blackfriars on the Thames Link route, plus about a train every two and a half minutes at peak on the Underground. So it's a very, very busy station. We've tried to keep disruption to a minimum. So the way we built the Underground station was to allow Underground trains to keep running through there the whole time. Although the station had to close, the District and Circle lines kept running. With regard to Thames Link trains, Thames Link route has stayed open again for pretty much the entirety of this programme, with just an 8-week closure two Christmases ago. So we've planned this job in order to keep people moving.
The scheme's part of a wider plan to get not just more but longer trains, in fact 250 metre long trains, through central London. And to do this at Blackfriars, the designers really only had one option.
Before we started at Blackfriars, there were 8 trains an hour could run through central London on Thames Link. Now we're up to 15. When the two new platforms open, we'll have 16 trains an hour. But the objective is to get 24 trains an hour running through the Thames Link route through central London. That means a train every 2.5 minutes. That's a metro-style service. It transforms the way this station will be used. The rationale of the Thames Link programme is to get more frequent trains running and also longer trains. At the moment, or before we started, 8 carriages was the maximum length you could have on this route. We're now up to 12 carriages. That doesn't sound like too much of an effort, but every platform at every station along this route has to be lengthened if 12 carriage trains are going to stop there. In a congested central London location like Blackfriars, that's massively complicated to do. Here, the only way we could do it was by extending the station over the River Thames so that the Victorian Rail Bridge, in effect, became the station.
So how did the renovation work?
Well, I caught up with Jamie Patel from Tony G and Partners. Her company was responsible for renovating the bridge, the north abutment, and also the south station structure. For the bridge, she said it was first a case of stripping everything back.
Because it's an old Victorian bridge, there was an element of having to remove the existing structure and rebuild on those existing members. After that was removed, it was replaced with new steelwork, and that came in by a barge in sections and was literally picked up off the barge, put into place and bolted together into the existing structure.
And when they stripped the bridge back, they found some unexpected damage.
During the World War II, a bomb was dropped and it landed just beneath the central span, which meant that there was quite a lot of shrapnel damage to the underside of the ribs and also actually to many of the other existing members. So we've had to go back in survey all the damage that had occurred because of the shrapnel damage and repair that so that it's fit for use.
And all of this had to be done working at height, over a river and sometimes next to live tracks. But what happened to all of the scrap? Robert Lyons from Network Rail explains.
Effectively, we've taken almost 100,000 tonnes of waste away on this program completely. Using the barges, we've taken away about 14,000 tonnes of waste, which would take lorries off the road from London and effectively decongest the area for our stakeholders on both the north and south sides of the program.
And the watch boats that kept an eye on the pickups and deliveries even managed to rescue a couple of people from the river, as well as help out boat crews in trouble.
But the work isn't ending there at Blackfriars, is it?
No, I caught up with David again. He said that there's actually an awful lot more work to do before all of these 12 carriage trains can stop at stations along the length of the Thames Link.
There's an upgrade going on at Farringdon that's of a similar scale to Blackfriars. And the next job, once we all pack up tools here, everyone's heading down to London Bridge because that's the last remaining bottleneck on the Thames Link route.
So the new station is operational now, but I think there are still a few things to go before it finishes in July, before the Olympics.
Indeed, yeah. Basically, there's a couple more platforms that have got to be finished, and then there's the solar array, which will look absolutely staggering when it's finished.
Amazing. Thanks for joining us, Casey.
Thank you very much.
And if you want to find out more about the Blackfriars Bridge, we have a website. No, we don't. Well, we do. We have a story on the website, in fact, where you can find out more and see an amazing time-lapse, actually, of the entire construction period. It's fantastic. Just search for Blackfriars and Wider.co.uk. You will find it. And on that note, we're going to end the show. But we've got something to tell you. We have a voicemail box, and you can call us and leave us a message, preferably under 30 seconds, for any of the stories we've talked about today. If you want us to play them out, just give us a call. You can call us on 0208 123 0468.
And we need some kind of jingle for that.
Do you think?
Yeah. We need, like, to, so that you can sing it, like the old Live and Kicking.
Oh, 811, 811, 811.
Yeah, but that's not the number. Can you do that with our number?
020 812. Oh, no, it's a weird number. There's too many digits.
I think you could do 0208 123 0468.
Oh, hello.
That works.
Okay, yeah. Get on it on your garage band or whatever it is that you use on your iPad.
Anyway, that number is open to anyone. It's an automated mailbox. Don't worry, you're not calling us to leave us a message that we're going to write down. Just call us up, leave us a message, 30 seconds or less, please. But of course, regular contact methods also still available. podcast@wired.co.uk is our email address. facebook.com/wiredUK is our Facebook page, growing by the day, and some fantastic conversations taking place on there each and every day. And Liv, what is our Twitter address?
We are twitter.com/wiredUK.
Oh, we so are. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, 0208 123 0468. That sort of works, doesn't it?
Thanks, Duncan.
Sort of. I think we need to work on that a little bit.